Welcome to another episode of the Perceptive Podcast here on Game Wisdom, where we examine the art and science of games. We've got a great cast for you this week. We're going to be talking to an indie developer who has been working on a Metroidvania title in his free time. He's been doing it now for just about 2 years, and we're going to discuss the work that he's done, as well as some of the lessons he's learned about Metroidvania design in the process. So, please welcome to the cast for tonight. He goes by the name Shield on Twitter, and that's what he is commonly referred to as among indie devs.
Hello, what's up, everyone?
Hey, Shield, it's great to have you on tonight. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. It's great to be here.
All right. It's great to have you on. We are recording this just at the tail end of January, and winter seems to be coming on and off around where I'm at. How are things where you're at?
Actually, we had a ton of snow this year. We actually had the first white Christmas in like 3 years. But currently, at this point of the time of the month, it's kind of melting and the snow's all going away. And we're kind of transitioning into spring a little bit. Mm-hmm. But I imagine if it goes the way we did last few years, it'll be some more snow in March.
Yeah, I'm hoping it'll be nice and chilly for my birthday in early February, but it was like, I think like 50 degrees here today. It was like nice and relaxing, and then like last week, I think we had like a little bit of snow then, so who knows what's happening with the weather these days.
Yeah, it's up and down crazy all the time.
Mm-hmm. So, since this is your first time on the podcast, Shield, could you talk a little bit about your background in the industry and what you're working on right now?
All right, so my background is not that much at the moment. I've had a 2 years on my current game, and this is my first attempt at an actual professional-level game. Mm-hmm. Before that, I've done several years' worth of smaller projects that I've done in my free time, like as a college student. And so most of my games are small little projects I work on just for the fun of it. Mm-hmm. And Stone of Corn is the first one that I'm actually trying to put out there and get off the ground and stuff. So I've put a lot more time into this one than I have any other game in the past.
Mm-hmm. And as we said a few minutes ago, this is also going to be a Metroidvania in terms of its design. And that genre, we could probably have a whole discussion on that actual topic in a few minutes, but when it comes to Metroidvania design, that's considered one of the more advanced kinds of design to build a game around. So, I guess, what attracted you to it as your first, like, I guess, big game project?
Well, so, Stone of Corn is inspired by two main things. Ori and the Blind Forest and My Little Pony Friendship is Magic. Because in that show, there was an episode where a character gets turned to stone, and at the end of the episode, she gets turned back to normal. So my question was, what happens if she didn't get turned back to normal, and she had to remain stone for the rest of her life? So that's what my game is about. It's about someone who got turned to stone, and they have to live with it. So then what then? And then, in terms of Metroidvania stuff, so that's the story behind, like, the story of the game. And then why it's Metroidvania is because my favorite game of all time is Ori and the Blind Forest. And the reason why I like it is because it has really good mechanics. Like, one of the philosophies of the dev team was that you have to do mechanics, make them feel right first before you make it pretty. And that definitely shows in the end result. And Ori and the Blind Forest was like one of the first games that really felt like the controls were tight enough that when I made a mistake, it was my mistake and not the game's missing my controls. Mm-hmm. Or missing my inputs. And so I really like that about it, and I want to make a game like it because I really like the mechanics of the game. So Ori and the Blind Forest is a Metroidvania game, and that's more or less why I chose to make Stone of Corn Metroidvania too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and for me, like my very, I guess what would be my first example of Metroidvania will of course be Super Metroid. And that was way before the genre even had a name. But I think pretty much, I'm sure everyone listening to this right now, at least among my fan base, probably knows Castlevania Symphony of the Night as like the first like really breakout example of the genre.
Yeah, I actually had a discussion with this about someone last night on Twitter. And this person didn't realize that the first Castlevania wasn't actually a Metroidvania. It's interesting how like it was a sequel of Castlevania that actually started the genre.
Mm. Just hearing that, I think I just got like a stab in my heart that someone didn't know that the original Castlevania was now Metroidvania. I think that just wounded me there a little bit.
Oh, okay. Well, there's some people who think Rogue Legacy is the Metroidvania. Mm. Like, there's a misconception in the in some parts of the community that a Metroidvania has to do with platforming mechanics and like how you traverse a level and. They don't understand like some of the core concepts of what makes a Metroidvania.
We're going to be talking about that. Also, I just had a hard day's work. I don't need this extra stress on my heart today.
Okay, I'll spare you that.
But okay, we've talked about Metroidvanias plenty of times, both here on the podcast as well as on our live talks. It is a very fascinating genre in terms of what it offers to design, as well as the challenges that go into building a game around that. And we'll probably be spending the majority of our cast discussing that. But getting back to Stonycorn, in terms of, I guess, developing the game, as I said a few minutes ago, you've been working on this game on and off for about 2 years, is that right?
Yep.
I guess, what has been, like I said, like, this is your first big project. What has been, I think, like, one of like, the more interesting or unassuming challenges of designing the game, like for any other indie developers who may be listening?
So one of the hardest challenges I've found in developing the game is player communication of the mechanics, mm-hmm. Or making them intuitive. So I've also taken inspiration from a game called The Witness, if you've heard of that, by Jonathan Blow. Mm-hmm. And in that game, they have one little pop-up of what the controls are, and then the rest of the game you have to figure out by yourself. And I thought that was so cool how he did that incrementally by showing one rule little by little, and then you eventually understand like how the whole thing works without any text tutorials at all. Mm-hmm. So I've tried to implement in Stonycorn so far, it's very difficult to teach players what the mechanics are without giving them text tutorials. One game that I know did this very well was Mega Man. Mega Man, there's that one video by Eager Raptor who talks about how the controls of Mega Man were introduced slowly to the player. And as I go through trying to figure out how to communicate my mechanics to the player, I realized that one thing that I didn't count for at the beginning was that the controls for the Mega Man were very simple in that the original controller only had like 8 buttons or 6 buttons, or it's like a really small amount. So there wasn't all that much you could do. But on a PC, you have hundreds of buttons. So it could be the player can't really figure out what buttons to press without having some kind of on-screen thing. Mm-hmm. So my game is also, I'm going to make an Android release too, eventually. And on the Android screen, there's all sorts of different things you could do with that too, because touching, you could tap, you can hold, you can drag, you can pinch zoom, and then beyond that, you can do all sorts of crazy gestures like right angle swipe or and stuff like that if you wanted to. Mm-hmm. So Android, with touchscreen, you could also have very a lot of complex controls. And trying to communicate what you have to do with a touchscreen is difficult without words.
Yes.
So mm-hmm. what I've been trying to do some visual indicators without words that say, oh, hey, here's where you have to tap, to try to get that to work. And I'm still in the process of getting that to work, function correctly. But one of the challenges that I've been facing is getting the player to understand what the controls are, and then after that, understand what the controls do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And like especially with that kind of touchscreen, because it's all gesture-based, it's not as easy as just saying, press B to shoot a fireball, or press A to jump. Now, you said it's going to be out for Android. Are you also planning on doing it for other platforms as well?
Yes. So, PC is one of them. So, the current controls, you can play with a touchscreen or with the mouse. Mm-hmm. I don't have any keyboard controls at the moment, but I might put those in eventually. And if I can get, if I can actually make a build for them, I'll make an iOS and Mac build. Though I'm not very familiar with either of those two platforms. But you know, I'm building my game in Unity, so I can just click a few things and it builds it for the that one device. But you know, there's some optimizations you have to make for each platform that I'm not at the moment familiar with.
Mm-hmm. In terms of the, I guess, complexity of Sony Corn, what kind of audience are you aiming for in terms of the design?
Well, I think that if I aim for being age appropriate for children, then I'll have a bigger audience. But there's some things that there's some topics that I want to talk about in the game that kind of that might make it unsuitable for children. And so for terms of complexity, like, well, I guess I'm kind of designing it for myself because I really like puzzle games with really clever puzzle mechanics where they kind of make you think about how the mechanics work and get you to have a really good understanding of what the mechanics do. And those kind of puzzles are can be kind of complex. And I actually don't think that a child would have a problem with these kind of mechanics. I'm pretty sure a child could figure out a puzzle game if the mechanics were introduced, gradually, like in The Witness. I think any child could complete The Witness. So I don't think the difficulty of the puzzles is going to have like an age limit or an age category. But I think some of the content I might put in the game, if I still decide to put in the game, will actually age gate some of the children out. But the current version of the game is age appropriate for everyone. There's no mature content in there at the moment.
Okay. Now, I guess in terms of the gameplay itself, one of the major parts of Metroidvania designs, there's usually some kind of unique mechanic or system that kind of controls or is the foundation for the rest of the design. With Stony Corn, is there anything in terms of the gameplay that would set it apart from other Metroidvania-based games?
Yes. So in all games, well, not all games, but actually pretty much all platformers, the character traverses the map linearly. Like, to get from point A to point B, they have to traverse space between point A and point B. In Stony Corn, the main mechanic is teleporting. So instead of having to traverse the space between it, he just goes straight there. So having the teleporting actually is, speaking of challenges, that's also another challenge that I have to work with, is because teleporting as a mechanic is very hard to balance, in that if you gave him free range with the ability, then it's OP and you can't make any puzzles on it because he could just skip over the puzzle with ease. And then, you know, like, even casual players would be speedrunning the game essentially. And I actually have some testers who like breaking the game, and they just like go all over the place, and I'm like, oh crap, how do I control this? The teleporting is the main mechanic in the game. So to make it not so OP, I gave it a range, and I made it so that you can't telefrag. And telefragging, if for those who don't know, is where you teleport into an object and then make it explode. There's a game called Warp. I don't remember who it's by, but it's about a little yellow alien, and he can telefrag into enemies and make them explode into little giblets. And I decided that I didn't want to do that because then if I could make it so he couldn't teleport into the ground, then I could make walls that are too thick for him to teleport through because of his teleport range. Mm-hmm. So the teleporting is an ability that I've had trying to work around to make it not so OP. And then the other abilities in the game, they're all based around the teleporting. In the version I sent you, I haven't actually put the new version of the of one of the abilities in because I haven't made the puzzles for that new ability yet. But the old ability, it was OP in that it was the first ability you got, and then once you got that, you could actually go straight to the end of the game with that one ability and ignore the rest of the abilities completely. So like, okay, this is a little too OP. I gotta fix this. And then I had other problems with other abilities making other abilities useless. Which is one of the main problems with making Metroidvania, is that you have to make sure all your abilities A, work together, and B, don't make each other obsolete.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is... so, I love Ori and the Blind Forest, but this is my one complaint about it, is that they have a wall jump ability, and they have a climb ability, and the only difference is that climb allows you to stay in place on a wall, and wall jump just makes you kind of, like, fall down slowly on the wall. So, to me, climb makes wall jump useless, and so... I don't know why they have both of those in the game, but they do. That's like one of my few complaints about the abilities in Ori and the Blind Forest. So noting that in that game, I was trying to make abilities that don't do that to each other. And currently only have 3 in the game, but I'm planning on adding 6. And I decided that to keep them from being... make each other useless, I add like special secondary effects to each of the abilities, so that even though if you're trying to use them for traversal only, some of them might overlap and like make others useless, but if you're trying to use them for world manipulation, then each ability is unique in what they do and what they add to the table.
Mm. And in terms of, I guess, the overall length of the game, I guess what would be like the max number of abilities that you're thinking about putting into Stony Corn?
So I'm planning on putting about 6 abilities that you get throughout the game. And then I have 2 innate abilities that could have been added separately, but I couldn't figure out how to make them separate and make them feel good. So I kind of put them in at the beginning, but you don't know they're there exactly until you are shown how to use them later in the game. So there's going to be 6 abilities that you get throughout the game. And I'm thinking of doing something slightly different in terms of like the Metroidvania design. I think there's going to be like 6 core levels where you get the abilities and you learn how to use them. And then outside of that, there's going to be maybe 10 or so levels that are extra bonus areas that are not completely necessary to complete the game, but they're like help you get, I don't know, the good ending or something. I'm not completely sure how that's going to work yet, because I've only got like 6 levels so far and 3 abilities, and having 19 levels total is going to be a really long time. So I'll have to see how much time I have for what kind of scope.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've already talked about the teleportation as one of the main mechanics in Stony Corn. In terms of like the other abilities that you're thinking about, are they going to be, I guess, supplemental to teleporting, or are they going to be, like, completely different from one another?
Yes, all the abilities are going to be separate from each other, like, different from each other, but they augment the teleport, basically. So, it's not in the build that I sent you, because I didn't think of this until a month or two ago, when I started making the experimental build. But the abilities are going to be activated depending on how you use the teleport. For example, I have a wall climb, I guess. You can't really say it's wall jump because it's teleporting. But he has a wall jump where if you teleport up against a wall, he can... because normally he can only teleport when he's on the ground. But when you're up against a wall with the wall jump ability, you can teleport up the wall. And... Yeah, so that's like... In that context, that ability gets used when you're up against a wall. Another ability gets used when you teleport in the air. So that's the context. But then beyond that, I have an ability that makes explosion force that launches you in a certain direction and launches other objects in a certain direction. And you charge that by teleporting really rapidly. So if you teleport really rapidly, then you can get this really force explosion that blasts objects in other directions and stuff. And then on the flip side, if you don't teleport at all, then that activates another ability that generates an electric field to power objects. It also has the effect of slowing things down, so that if you want to stop an object from moving, you could use that. So those two abilities, they activate depending on how you use a teleport ability. So although they're completely different than teleporting, they augment the teleport ability, and help you do the things that you're trying to do in the game.
Okay. Now, I guess one thing we haven't talked about yet would be the actual puzzles in Stony Corn, because you've mentioned a lot of the different mechanics. In terms of the puzzles that you're thinking about for the game, Are they going to be, I guess, more of like a logic-based puzzle, or is it going to be more about kind of like a transversal puzzles? You know, how do I get from A to B?
So far, a lot of the puzzles are traversal puzzles because those are the easiest to make. Because if you have a puzzle that's not traversal, you kind of have to expect that the player is going to skip over it. Mm-hmm. So especially the puzzles where I have to have the player learn something about the ability, it has to be traversal because otherwise the player could skip that part and then not get the information that they needed from that puzzle. For example, there's one puzzle in the game where you have to stop this block from moving so that you can put it into a spot where it opens a door. And you have to figure out that, oh, hey, my ability that I just got allows me to stop this block and move it into the right spot. And if you could just go past it, then you wouldn't learn that about the ability. And that's important for later in the game. Mm-hmm. So in terms of other puzzles, I'm thinking that word manipulation puzzles would also be very good for this game, but I haven't completely figured out how those will work yet and what kind of incentive the player will have for completing those puzzles.
All right. Now, I guess at this point, in terms of like having a release or an end point in time, it's probably still too far in the development to be thinking about like how much longer the game is going to be in development for.
I'm hoping it's going to be only 4 years total, but I'm halfway to 4 years and I'm not halfway to completion. So either I'm going to have to reduce the scope a lot or I'm going to take a lot more time. Like Owlboy took 10 years, so I might take that long. I don't know. Hopefully not. but yeah, if I reduce the scope, it's going to be released sooner probably.
Mm-hmm. All right. So, I think with that, is there anything else in terms of Sony Corner's design that we haven't touched on that you'd like to bring up now? Or we can move on to talking more about Metroidvania design in a, I guess, a high-level discussion.
Well, now that you bring that up, there is one interesting thing that I decided to put into Sony Corner, and that is a time rewind system. So that was one of the neat abilities that I mentioned before. As I didn't say it mentioned before, but that's one of the innate abilities that I talked about. So basically what it is that you can, at any time, any point in the game, you can rewind back to any other place that you teleported, but it also rewinds time to back to what it was when you first teleported there. So it kind of has like a mechanics of a Braid where you can move back in time, but Braid was all about time manipulation. In this game, it only uses time manipulation to get you out of tough spots. Like sometimes there could be a case where you make a puzzle go into a state that you can't actually win, so you get on a winnable state. And so having the time rewind mechanic allows you to undo that unwinnable state. That's basically what it's there for. It's also there to reinforce the idea of that I have not put this in the game, but I'm going to do this eventually, is that the events in the game, they don't happen when you get there. They happen whether or not you're there. And this is to solve the problem of rubber banding. Like in Ori the Blind Forest, the Ginzo Tree, which is the most famous level in the entire game because it's so hard, which is actually my personal favorite. But some people complain that the water level that chases you through the level, and it kills you when it gets to you, but it rubber bands. So if you go faster, it speeds up and stays on you. But if you go slow, then it slows down and gives you some breathing room. And people didn't like that because it felt kind of fake, or some people didn't like it. I personally didn't notice it, but I noticed that in some games, like certain things happen only when you do certain things, and it kind of feels fake, like everyone's waiting around for you, even though there's an emergency. Like, if there's an emergency, but nothing will happen until you do this certain thing, so you don't have to hurry. You can just like take your time and figure things out, and that kind of like betrays the feeling of the moment that the game creator is trying to create. So by having everything work on a system clock independent of the player, then that means that everything feels more real, and that if you don't hurry for this third thing, you could actually miss it. But the flip side of that is that if you don't do things when the player activates a certain trigger, is that the player can miss important things and not be able to complete the story. So to circumvent this, I decided to have a game last for like only one day, only one in-game day, and then have a reset at the end of that day. So at the end of the day, the player character resets all the way back to the beginning, and the whole game world resets. So then you could go through the whole game over again. But the thing about that is that then you lose all your progress. But to solve this, I have the memories. So the player character stores memories of the game world. So if you've been to a certain location before, you can get back to that very easily, because there's teleporters all throughout the world. And once you activate them, you can very easily go back to them. So you don't actually lose any progress in the game, but you still have the game reset. So if you miss an event, you can rewind back to the beginning of the day and then teleport there right then, so that you can actually catch that event before it happens, so that you can actually see things that you missed. Not all that is in there yet, like the time rewind mechanic is, but the game world doesn't reset yet because they don't actually have events going on with the NPCs and stuff. But when I get more of the story in and like get actually like events going on, then that will be in the game, and everything.
All right, very interesting. So I think with that, let's move on and talk a little bit more about Metroidvania design and what you've learned from playing games and how that's kind of helped to infer on developing Stony Corn. I think that will probably take us through to the end of our talk for tonight. So here's, I guess, the first question. It's one that we always like to ask when it comes to Metroidvania-based games. But I also saw this debate on Twitter from someone else, and that is Metroidvania at this point considered its own genre or not? What do you think, Shield?
Well, I like to consider it a genre because it's like video game genres, they're kind of like hard to define. They're like different than movie genres or book genres. And I like to say the word genre because it's the easiest word to say, like category and like type. I guess those are easy to say, but to me, genre is easy to say. But I read an article online by a game developer who actually made like I think Nintendo games or something, and he says that Metroidvania is not a genre, but it's a category. I don't like to argue that too much, so I don't really care. But the reason why he says it's not a genre is because 2D platformer and FPS, those are two different genres. And Metroidvania, an FPS and a platformer could both be a Metroidvania, so that's why he says it's something different. Yeah, so that's like what the difference between those is, because like to me, The Witness is actually Metroidvania in a certain way, and then like Riverbind Forest, that's a 2D platformer, and that's a Metroidvania. So it's not really important to what a Metroidvania is, I guess, whether or not it's a genre. Mm-hmm.
All right, then I guess continuing from that question, then, in your opinion, what do you think actually makes a game a Metroidvania?
Okay, so to be a Metroidvania, you first have to have a player character that starts weak, like not completely helpless, but he has to start without core abilities. And then as the game progresses, he gets more and more abilities that he keeps through the whole game. And then you also have to have a world where you can go back to places and use those abilities in new ways. So these abilities have to unlock new areas, but in addition to that, they also have to change how you play the game in a fundamental way. And a lot of how I define a Metroidvania is also based on the article that I read by this one guy. Let's see if I can actually find that, I guess. But yeah, so all my ideas of what a Metroidvania is comes from that one professional. But I have a lot of ideas that also come from my experience of playing Metroidvania games and making this particular one. But yeah, that's the core thing, is a world that changes when you get abilities and that you get new abilities throughout the course of the game. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, man, I think that's a major point about it, in my opinion as well, that there has to be a difference between the beginning, middle, and end in terms of what the player is doing or manipulating the character with.
Aha, uh-huh, okay, so I did find it. It's a guy Kynan Pearson, and I don't remember where he worked, but that's the guy who has this really cool article about what a Metroidvania is and what the difference between genre and category is for Metroidvanias and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now, as we've talked about before in the first section with Stonycorn, one of the challenges of developing a game along a Metroidvania design has to be the abilities and powers, because it's very easy, as you said, to either make powers that either over just, you know, break the game, or they're just too similar. Like, we've seen lesser examples of Metroidvanias that all your powers you get simply just, like, open up a door. Like, you get the fire power, and all it does is let you walk through fire at specific points. I guess my next question for you is, what do you think, I think, makes a good Metroidvania, and what do you think makes one that doesn't quite work?
Yeah, I think you just said it right there. To make a good Metroidvania, you have to have abilities that complement each other, they work well together, and they don't overshadow each other, in that they don't make one ability does not make another ability useless. And three, they change the gameplay in a core way. So, like, some abilities could act like keys to open new areas, and that's fine, but they can't be the only thing that they do. Like, if you have combat in your game, the ability also has to affect how you use that ability in combat and how you approach combat situations. Yeah, I think that's what I had to say about core Metroidvania design for abilities.
All right. Now, one thing that we've seen, or especially from the independent scene over the last few years, have been more games adopting Metroidvania. And there was a time that it seemed like you couldn't, you know, throw a stone on the Steam page without hitting a Metroidvania game from an indie developer. And the genre has, or I'm just going to call it a genre for right now, because we don't have the time to get into an argument there. But in terms of making these Metroidvania games, we've certainly seen a wide variety, and not just in terms of platform or movement-based games. We've seen some like Aquaria, I think it was like Journey of the Last Human or something along those lines. So we have seen some that go into very interesting areas. I guess as an interesting question for you, Shield, what has been, like, in terms of like powers or mechanics, like your favorite examples from a Metroidvania, like something that, you know, really made the world or the game space pop after you get it?
Well, Ori and the Blind Forest, I have to go back to this. The Bash ability. The Bash ability is my favorite ability ever, because it's both a movement ability and a word manipulation ability, and it's useful in so many different contexts. And on top of that, it doesn't make any other abilities useless, because it's kind of like a situational ability, but the situation happens so often during the game that it feels like you can use it at any time. So basically, for those who don't know, the Bash ability in Ori is where you go up next to an object, like a boulder or an enemy. Then you activate the ability, and then it sends you flying in one direction, and it sends the enemy or object in the other direction. So using this, you can move boulders onto triggers that activate doors, and you can blast enemies off cliffs. And then you can also use enemies to go to heights that you couldn't before, because some areas you can't get to without using the Bash ability. Interestingly enough. So yeah, for me, the Bash ability is my favorite ability of any Metroidvania game I've seen.
Interesting. I'm trying to think of some good examples, but I've just played way too many games to try and distill it down to one or two. Now, one thing that we've talked about when we were discussing Stonycorn, I think is also very relevant here, is level design in a Metroidvania. Because this is one of the harder aspects of designing these games, because you have to design levels in a way that it allows for easy traversal, but at the same time, there also has to be ways to get around, you know, when things change in the future. Like, for instance, in, like, a Castlevania or in Castlevania Symphony of the Night, once you get the ability to do, like, your super jump up or transform into the Bat or Fog, the levels have to be designed to accommodate that, just as they were designed when you didn't have those abilities.
One thing that Ori does, and this is probably one of the easier things to do for people who are new to Metroidvanias, is you have secret areas in the game that, like, in the beginning of the game, that you can't get to unless you have a certain ability. And there'll be certain markers for the player to know that this is a secret area that you can get to later, but you can't get to it now because you don't have the ability yet. So there's a main path and there's secret paths off to the side. And Ori does this a lot. And that's also what I've done in Sonicorn, because some of the puzzles in my game, they make it, they're so ridiculously easy when you get the new abilities. Because the puzzles in the first area, they assume that you don't have the wall jump ability yet, so they're all about getting to the top of the ledge, the next ledge. But when you get the wall jump ability, that level becomes really easy, and you can skip all the puzzles in it, because mm-hmm. you've already done them, so you get this ability that lets you skip them completely. So that's kind of like one thing that you can do in Metroidvania, is like to show you that, oh, hey, now they have this ability in this old area that was really hard for you. You could just completely dance all over it because you have all these really cool things that you can do now that you couldn't do before. It's like in Ori, they also did this because they have this ability called the charge jump, where you can hold the up key for a certain amount of time on the ground, and that launches you straight up in the air. And this allows you to get around so many things that you couldn't before. Like in the double jump area, if you have this ability, you can completely skip a good third of that area and like get to the objective way sooner than you should have. So you have to kind of plan around what kind of puzzles you're going to have for your abilities and make sure that you don't have prior abilities that make you let you to skip things. So you have to order the abilities that you get in the order that you can design puzzles for them, and you have to ensure that the puzzles you design for this ability can't be solved by just using another ability in a different way. Players want to get like really creative, but you don't want to make anything really obvious. Mm-hmm. So you want to make sure that the puzzle for this ability can really only be solved by this ability because of how the abilities work together. And I really am against having ability shutdown where you have to use this ability for this puzzle because your other abilities mm-hmm. aren't working anymore. You don't want to do that. You don't want to take their abilities away. You want to design the puzzles in such a way that the only way to solve it is by using this new ability that you got. And then the old abilities aren't useless. They're just ineffective in this situation.
Yeah. Now, speaking about the abilities, here's a very interesting question. I'm sure you probably ran into this with playtesting Sonicorn. And that is being able to show the player or being able to teach the player how these abilities will work and grow things from there. For instance, when I'm thinking about like games like the Talos Principle or the Swapper, which may not be considered Metroidvanias, but they dealt with a lot of abstract and lateral thinking in terms of what they wanted the player to do. And when you're talking about like a Metroidvania-based game and you're introducing these new mechanics, it can be very tricky to teach the player about, okay, this is how this mechanic works, but if you do it a little bit like this, suddenly it changes its function. And of course, you mentioned The Witness. I think that would be a really big example of this, with how every puzzle technically builds off of the same foundation, but things are tweaked in ways to make them feel different.
That's a very interesting thing to talk about. So for introducing new abilities, you have to think about what are the key things that the player has to know about the ability in order to progress through the game. This is one of the mistakes that I made when I first made the first level in Sonicorn. The first level has no extra abilities in it. It's just telling you how to use a teleport mechanic. And there's a lot to that because players aren't used to teleporting around all the time. So I thought, oh, the important thing the players to know is they have to be able to cross gaps, and they know that they can teleport exactly where they want to teleport to cross gaps. But then that turned out to be ineffective because at the very end of the level, I was like, oh, and by the way, you can teleport through walls. Mm-hmm. But when players got to that part, they're like, okay, there's a wall here. How do I teleport through this? Mm-hmm. And they got stuck because they didn't know they could teleport through walls. So I was like, oh, okay. So that's probably one of the things I should show at the beginning, because there's also the effect that to progress forward, sometimes players don't know if they're supposed to keep going the way they're going or they should go back and try to find an area. So by putting this one thing at the end of the level, players thought they had to backtrack because they missed something and they couldn't get through this part. So I had to put the wall at the very beginning of the level. And then at that point, the play area was so small, it was like, okay, this has to be the way I have to go because there's... Mm-hmm. it's the only way I can go. And then they realize, oh, I could teleport through walls. Okay, this makes sense now. So you have to kind of figure out what the key parts of the ability the player needs to know. And then you have to make a separate puzzle, probably maybe several puzzles, depending on how complex the idea is, and tell the player through mechanics, like, okay, so this here's a situation where you have to do this part of the ability, and you can't get through it until you figure out that the ability can do this. And you have to kind of make the puzzle, design the puzzle such a way that makes the player discover that this is how the ability works. And that is a very tricky thing to do, and that's kind of a thing you have to experiment with on a case-by-case basis with your abilities. One of the more challenging abilities I've been working with is the Force Whip ability, which I've just recently reworked. But in its build that I sent you, it has the same problem where players don't realize they can hold. So this is a problem with the gesture, too, in this particular ability. So it introduces a new gesture and a new way of using things. So the original way is you hold it, and then it blasts a boulder into a wall. And then from then on, the player thinks they have to have the boulder to break the wall. But they can also break the wall with just the ability. And I was trying to figure out how to get the player to realize they can just break the wall. And I've had mixed success with that. Designing puzzles that actually teach you each of the individual pieces is actually very difficult. Yeah. And I haven't actually got that down to a science yet. But I'm making progress on getting that to be understandable.
Mm-hmm. And that actually is a good segue into this next question that I have. And that is trying to break down your mechanics in terms of complexity. And this probably leads into a greater discussion to be had on tutorial design. But for fans of Game Wisdom, you know, we've talked about designing tutorials and guiding the player in terms of understanding the game. And a major part of that is being able to present your mechanics in an order, both in terms of utility and complexity. So, I guess for you, Shil, in terms of what you're thinking about with Metroidvania design, how do you decide what is considered, you know, an advanced mechanic, and what's considered, you know, a beginner one, and so on?
Well, if you're talking about a single ability, an advanced mechanic is something that you have to know. You have to know the other ones first. So the basic one, you don't have to know the really fine details of how the ability works. You just have to know, oh, it does this certain thing in this situation. And then as you get down later to the advanced mechanics, you're introduced to more situations where just using the basic part of the ability doesn't work anymore. I can't think of any examples at the moment, but basically you introduce the basic thing first. Like it's the basic, most core intuitive thing the player can think of. Like it's the easiest to understand. And it's the one that you can describe in the least amount of words. That's probably a good metric for determining which is simpler, I assume. After that, you introduce the player to more situations where using the basic part of the ability doesn't work anymore, so you have to figure out new ways of using the ability. And then that's when you get into the advanced mechanics, where you're in a situation where the basic stuff doesn't work anymore, just because it's like not as effective as the advanced mechanics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And again, it's very tricky to try and nail that down, especially when you're dealing with very esoteric or unique mechanics to begin with. As I said a few minutes ago, games like the Swapper or the Talos Principle, they give you very unique powers or unique puzzle-solving tools, but they're not really, I guess, seen in other games, or not in that exact manner. So you're kind of having all the players approach your game at the same point of zero in terms of their knowledge of the design.
Yeah, because every game has its unique abilities. But in certain genres, like 2D platformer Metroidvanias, pretty much everyone I've seen has a wall jump ability. So pretty much once you know one game's wall jump ability, you pretty much know all of them, except like certain games also have different twists on the wall jump ability or other abilities you can have. Like double jump is also a really popular one. Mm-hmm. But wall jump, I've seen Ori and the Blind Forest, you can wall jump anywhere except for cliffs that have more than a 90 degree angle. So if you're if you're on the bottom of a diagonal cliff, then you can't wall jump up that. And then Dust, Elysian Tail, you can only wall jump up vines. So it's not actually a wall jump. It's like more like a vine climb thing, but it functions like a wall jump does. In Guacamelee, you have a wall jump, but in that game, they have green walls that you can't wall jump up. And the reason why they have the green walls is so that they force you to use another ability that you just got. But it's like a different way that the wall jump works in that game, I guess. Mm-hmm.
All right. I'm trying to think if there's any other general questions I have regarding Metroidvania design for tonight, because I know we are about 50 minutes in, so I think we can probably wrap things up in the next few. But when it comes to the Metroidvania aspects, I guess one of the interesting things we've seen, and I think this goes back to that misconception about what is and isn't a Metroidvania, is that a lot of people will associate Metroidvania to RPG mechanics. Again, thanks to Castlevania Symphony of the Night. But
yes,
it's not really, I think, a requirement. I just want to get your thoughts on that.
I completely agree. The RPG mechanics are a flavoring. It's not a requirement. So Ori and the Blind Forest has an RPG mechanics in that you can level up and get add-ons to your abilities. So none of the add-ons are essential. In fact, there's a achievement for not using any of the upgrades. But some of the upgrades are like you can make your double jump a triple jump. And another upgrade is you can increase your firepower for this one ability. You can decrease the mana cost. You can make this ability give you an extra life when you use it. So it's nothing essential to the gameplay. It's just something to help you along and make you feel stronger. And actually, a lot of it is utilitarian, too, like with that. But RPG mechanics in Metroidvanias are not necessary at all. Dust, Legion, Tales, RPG mechanics. Well, The Witness, if you consider The Witness Metroidvania, that has no RPG mechanics in it at all. And that is just fine. Stone of Corn, I'm not planning on having that in the Stone of Corn at all. Interestingly enough, I actually did put RPG mechanics in Stone of Corn at the beginning. So it was a little different, though, because when you teleport, every time you teleport, it increases a number for XP, and then you got so much XP, it increases your teleport range just a little bit. And so over time, your range would be increased by a lot, so that would be one way that you're stronger. But I found out is that you could just skip any puzzle you wanted just by teleporting frequently enough to increase your range. So I was like, okay, I can't have that kind of RPG mechanic in the game. So I haven't actually put anything like that in the game since, and I realized that Metroidvanias and RPGs don't always get along, in that you have to carefully consider what you're actually incrementing. Like damage, like attack power is a pretty common one to increment, and that's pretty much pretty safe. But like jump distance, jump height, run speed, those all can be very dangerous things for Metroidvanias to have RPG mechanics for, because all the levels have to be carefully crafted to your specific jump height, jump speed, jump distance, that kind of thing. Because if they're not carefully crafted, then the player is either too easily get through all the levels, or the player can hardly ever get through the levels. So having RPG mechanics for those just doesn't make any sense for Metroidvania. Mm-hmm. But that's also the reason why RPG mechanics it's their problem is that either the bosses, like even if you have like attack power to upgrade, either the bosses are too easy or they're too strong, and it requires you to grind a little bit for that. And that's the main issue with RPGs that I see, which, interestingly enough, Undertale did a pretty good job of solving that problem, I think. Mm-hmm. But that's like another topic.
Yes, it is. Yeah, that's a good another like 30-40 minutes that we start talking about Undertale.
Yeah.
But yeah, I agree with you about that, Shield, in terms of the RPG systems. They can lead to some very artificial gates. I know I ran into a few playing some of the Castlevania games where it didn't matter how great I was at getting around the enemy's attacks. If I wasn't leveled up enough or I didn't have the strong enough gear, the bosses would just take forever to get through. And that's always a challenge when you have combat-based Metroidvanias like that. And it's very interesting to see games that get away from that kind of RPG layer and just focus more on pure action. again, something like, I'm trying to remember, it's been so long, I can't remember if Query actually had an RPG system or not. Would you remember that?
I actually haven't played Aquaria yet. It's on my list of things to play. I actually have it in my Steam library, just haven't opened it yet. I'm still getting through Owlboy at the moment.
Yeah, Owlboy was pretty interesting, and it definitely had some very interesting touches, especially considering it took so long in terms of development. I'm sure there's a very fascinating story behind that.
Oh, yeah. There actually is a GDC talk or two about the design of Owlboy, and it's on my list of things to watch. I haven't done it yet because I don't want spoilers. it's actually a really well-made game. But going back to the topic that you talked about earlier, what was that? How do you get around the final boss problem where you have the boss is too strong for you because you're not leveled up enough? So I believe Dust had this problem, Dust Legion Tail, because they have RPG mechanics that increase your attack power. I remember some of the bosses were like really hard to get through because of my level. But Ori actually solved this in a unique way in that the attack power is only for the common enemies that you find in a everyday and all the regular level sections. And they're not actually really all that hard. Like they increase not because the difficulty increased not because they have higher health, but because they have higher, more difficult attack patterns. And the bosses in Ori are escape sequences. So you don't actually have to fight a boss. You just have to traverse this level fast enough before you get killed by the thing that's chasing you. And the reason why this works is because Ori the Blind Forest, their abilities are all about traversal. Every ability in Ori is pretty much... not every ability, but most of the abilities in Ori are traversal abilities that help you get from point A to point B faster or in a more interesting way. So it makes sense that the bosses would be escape sequences where you have to use those abilities to escape in interesting ways. And my favorite of those, as I mentioned before, is a Ginzo Tree, which a lot of people hate for some reason. But to me, the music in that one is like really good. That's getting off a little topic. Ori gets around the boss issue by not having bosses but escape sequences, which is also what Undertale does in a way, because the bosses don't actually die until they're meant to die. So you don't have to level up to beat them. You just have to survive until you get a last tag that you're supposed to get.
Yeah. Now, here's a very interesting question. I think this will probably be the one that we'll begin to wrap up on. And going back to, again, classifying a Metroidvania, I want to get your thoughts on this. One of the things that we've seen, especially over the last decade, has been the adoption of Metroidvania-based systems in a lot of 3D, like, open-world-style games. Your Assassin's Creed, Batman, Far Cry is an example as well, where characters are leveled up and they power up over the course of playing. Would you consider those games to still be part of Metroidvania-based design? Or do you think that it basically takes it in a direction that's not indicative of a Metroidvania?
Well, I have to be honest, I don't pay much attention to AAA's scene. I know what the titles are, like I heard the names, but I don't know what the mechanics are like. So I'd say as long as they have abilities that are that become core parts of how you play the game, and they finally change the game, and you get more abilities throughout the course of the game, and they affect the gameplay, and you can't complete the game without having these abilities, then I'd say yes, they are Metroidvanias. Even if they have like RPG mechanics in them, and I think they could still be classified as Metroidvanias. Open world stuff is actually very interesting because most Metroidvanias I know are actually linear. Like Ori and the Blind Forest has an open world in that it's interconnected and you can go from any world to any area to any area very easily, but you can only visit each area in sequence depending on when you get the abilities. So in that way, it's very linear. So having an open world Metroidvania, I'm actually not sure how that works exactly.
Mm-hmm. All right. Yeah, it could be very interesting to see someone try and implement that, because, again, The linearity is built into the level design itself. If you don't want the player to go a specific direction, you simply put a barrier or an obstacle that requires a specific ability that they don't have yet. And, I mean, one of the hallmarks of those will, of course, be like Super Metroid. And all the various powers that are required to get around certain things. But, of course, you give it to the proper speedrunner and they can just blaze right through it.
Yeah, that's also very interesting. Okay, that's a whole other topic for another time, but I did want to mention that there's like tons of different mixes with Metroidvania that you could have. Like, last night I was talking to some guy, and I realized you could actually have a roguelike Metroidvania. And when I first heard that, I was like, that's impossible. They're completely antithetical to each other. But I realized that you could have a randomly generated map that had the structure of a Metroidvania, but it was randomly generated. And, like, it had the same elements of, like, abilities required to go to different areas, but the levels are generated randomly. Mm-hmm. And then each time you die, you reset, and then you get the same abilities in the same order, or, like, maybe not that's required, but the levels will be randomly generated. And I thought that was a really interesting thing that I never thought of before. This kind of goes to show that Metroidvanias there are a certain set of mechanics, but they can be combined with lots of other different sets of mechanics from other games.
Mm-hmm, definitely. And again, there's so many interesting aspects in terms of building a Metroidvania that can really lend itself towards these different genres and different play styles as well. We've talked about, you know, action-based ones, puzzle-based ones, and even, again, ones that get rid of RPG mechanics and so on. And it's going to be very interesting to see, I guess, what will be, like, the next, you know, big break from the normal conventions of the genre. I guess that will probably be my final question then for you, Shiel. I guess, for you, where do you think, or what do you hope to see, like, Metroidvania games grow, like, in terms of, like, the genre or what mechanics can offer?
Well, I personally think that my definition of Metroidvania is really interesting, and games that fit this definition are interesting and they're worth playing because each ability that each game offers are different from each other and enough that makes each game feel unique. And that's why I love playing them so much. In terms of where Metroidvanias are going to go in the future, I imagine that Metroidvanias, they're only replayable in my opinion, and that you get like you go collect things and stuff, or that you didn't collect before, or that you have a really good story in the game and you just want to experience that again. Like, to me, Ori and the Blind Forest is like a Disney movie of games. Like, you play it again not because you're looking for something new, but because you just want to feel it again. You just want to hit play and sit back and relax again, like you did the first time. So to me, I think some Metroidvanias are going to be like really good story experiences because they're linear, that lends them well to having linear stories. And linear stories are always easier to implement. Mm-hmm. So I think that they're going to be, the replay value is going to be that you're going to experience the same story again, and it's enjoyable.
All right. I think that's a great way to wrap up on. I guess before we say goodnight for our cast, Shiel, any final thoughts or any you would like to elaborate on about Metroidvanias before we go into our ending?
Like I said, Metroidvania is my favorite genre, and I think I said pretty much most of my thoughts about them today. I can't think of anything else at the moment. And I'd like to thank you for interviewing me about this. This is like a topic of passion for me, and I really enjoyed talking with you today.
All right, not a problem. Maybe in the future, when you are further along in terms of Stony Corn's design, we can have you back on to kind of talk about what else you've learned or any other interesting tips you've picked up regarding designing Metroidvanias.
Yeah, that'd be great when I learn how to do abilities, tutorials more intuitively, and other stuff that I haven't quite figured out yet. I'll definitely bring you up, and like, hopefully by then I'll have an actual released game, so I'll have some experience with that, which will be very interesting.
All right. Well, She'll definitely be best of luck with the remaining development of Stony Corn.
Thank you.
All right. So I think with that, we are going to say goodnight for our cast. If people want to follow you or reach out to you, what do you mind giving out your Twitter handle or anything like that?
Yes. So my personal Twitter is at ShieldGenerator7 with no vowels in the generator because Twitter has a character limit. And then if you want to contact me about the game, I have an email, stoneacorn@gmail.com. And I'll send you that on the Skype thing so you can put it on the screen or whatever. And also my Twitter account for my game is at stoneacorn too. So that's a very good place to contact me. I check Twitter daily, check my email daily. So it's a good place to contact me.
Great. All right. So with all that said, we are going to say goodnight for our cast. So, for those of you listening, thank you so much for tuning in. And if you are an indie developer or someone who would like to come on for either a live or recorded cast, we are always looking for new guests. But if you like to support Game Wisdom and what I do, there are several options currently available. Besides being a podcast guest, if you'd like to write a guest piece for the site, you can find all the information under Submissions Wanted on the front page. You can follow me on Twitter at GWBicer for thoughts from me throughout the day, as well as updates when posts and such come out. Be sure to check out the Game Wisdom YouTube channel for regular videos on games, or I'm sorry, on game spotlights, indie game coverage, and of course our design topics. And last but not least, if you'd like to support us on Patreon, it is patreon.com/GWBicer. You can donate and get access to our private Discord channel where we talk design topics, early access to videos, and much more. But with all that said, once again, thank you for listening to this week's edition of the Perceptive Podcast. Tune in next time for another discussion on game design and the industry. Until then, have a great night.
Bye, everyone.